This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Baraja aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal, and in case you're wondering, Mike Pennant is currently packing his bags for Florida. I'm hoping he sends me a postcard. It's currently snowing here in Lexington, Kentucky, but the good news is that he will be bringing you live coverage from Gulfstream Park all winter, so don't forget to check that out. But thank you all for joining me this evening. To those of you tuning in to Sirius 220 XM 206, as well as to those of you listening via our website at horseracingradio.net. Tonight, we have a retired jockey joining us in studio, and he might be the first jockey I've met taller than myself, and he towered over the competition during his 15-year career. He won the 1990 Eclipse Award for Outstanding Apprentice. He has 3,085 victories to his name, and his mounts have earned over $56 million in earnings. I would like to welcome to the show Mark Johnston. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Christina. Good to be here.
You battled the blizzard and everything to join us here in studio. This is exciting.
Yeah, we made it. It wasn't too bad out there.
Not too bad.
It was a little rough this morning, everybody, but I was at home. I didn't go anywhere and just watched the news and watched everybody else battle with it.
Yes, not bad. That's the way to do it.
That's the way to do it.
Mark, those of our audience members listening right now who are familiar with the Maryland circuit and couple years ago, you just dominated the Mid-Atlantic circuit. And tell us, to start off the show, tell us what you're doing now.
Now, me and my wife, Tammy, we run a horse transportation business, and that's year-round here in Lexington. It's out of Lexington. And also, in the winter times, the Turfway meet, when it gets slow, I will take Jock's book, you know, and I've had a couple of riders here and there. So the transportation business keeps me real busy in the summer. It lightens up in the winter time. So
sure. And that's very interesting that you're an agent at times. And how has that transition been for you, given that you understand exactly what a jockey goes through? And then to cross over to the other side of the fence and to be an agent, how is that transition?
I think it helps, because I relate to, you know, what jockeys go through. As you well know, I think I know what a rider would want as far as his mounts, you know, what kind of horses he wants to ride, what kind of horses he may not want to ride. And I would hope I would add, you know, some experience to it and be able to help. And I like younger riders because, you know, they are teachable. And I had Jack Gilligan last winter at Turfway. Did very well, and he went a few races over there, and we rode for some really good people, and I enjoyed it. So, you know, we did good.
We actually had Jack here on the show a couple months ago, and Jack is fantastic. And so do you do that often with younger riders? Do you try to pull them aside and teach them along the way?
I do. It's different with every rider. You know, some riders are more receptive to help.
Sure.
And you know, I believe that the riders that you can help, I could see a big difference in their riding, you know, as they progressed, and that was very rewarding.
Of course, and Jack especially, he's tall as well. And so I know, you know, for a taller rider, it can be perhaps a little bit more difficult to look good on a horse. Did you try to help Jack along the way with that?
I did, and he was pretty natural at it. And the thing about Jack is he worked very hard at with the Equisizer, and he didn't have much problem looking good on a horse. I think it's overcoming the public's perception, or I should say actually the trainer's perception and the owner's, and because a lot of them are surprised when they first meet you and say, wow, this guy's awful tall for a jockey, can he ride? And I said to Jack, I said, you have to put that aside and just go out there and show him. I said, there's no way, you know, there's no other way that you can prove it but just to do it. You know, go out there, look like everybody else. Don't stand out as far as you want to stand out, but you don't want to stand out to the point to where, you know, they say, oh, there's Jack Gilligan or there's Mark Johnston, there's Christina, because they're tall.
Right.
You want to blend in, but yet you want to stand out when it counts.
That's exactly right. Well said, Mark. And so you're currently living in Paris, Kentucky, I believe.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We have a small farm there. We have some retired racehorses. My wife's big on rescue, and she did train horses for several years. She did real well in Cleveland. She had 30 head of horses, you know, racing up there when she was married to Michael Rowland, was her first husband. And we ventured out in training here in Kentucky. Very tough here to get clients. It's very, very hard in the wintertime. There's not a, you know, the money's just barely good enough to where you can make, you know, make it ends meet. And so, you know, we did struggle with trying to make it in Kentucky training horses. So we ventured into other, you know, another aspect of the business.
Of course, and that's fantastic to hear that she is so big on rescuing the animals that we rely on,
right,
for our business. And that's great news to hear. I have a retired thoroughbred of my own at home, so that's fantastic news.
It's very rewarding, and it's not just horses. We have dogs, alpacas.
Wow.
We have a lot of animals at the farm there. It's you know, it's not really a working farm. It's kind of a petting zoo type thing.
Hey, that's awesome.
That's what we enjoy. That's what brings us happiness, and we're able to do that. We're fortunate enough, and I think it helps, too, like you said, you know, to be able to rescue, especially horses that have been on the racetrack that deserve a good home. She has a horse there that he's still there. I think he's 14 years old. His name is Shoot It. And he won 13 or 14 races for her.
Wow.
So
she's paying him back.
Yeah, she's paying him back. And I would like, you know, if more people could be able to do that, it would be great. But, you know, it's a financial deal. And but there are more places that are rescuing horses and doing the right thing by, you know, the animals.
Absolutely.
And I like that. I appreciate that.
Of course. Of course. Now you say alpacas. Are those the animals that spit at you? I'm not too...
They never have. They spit at each other. Now, the llamas, they say, spit at you.
Oh, that's the llamas. Okay.
Yeah, the alpacas so far, like I said, they will spit at each other, but I have not been spit on by an alpaca yet. That's good.
Glad to hear that.
They might have to find a new home.
They know better, though.
That's right.
They know better.
No, they're good.
So you're back in Kentucky because you grew up here as well.
I did grow up in Kentucky. I went to school right up the street here. High school, I went to Lafayette, spent most of my younger years in Springfield, Kentucky, Lebanon, Kentucky. I was born in Lebanon, Kentucky, very small towns, kind of a farm boy type. But me and my mother moved to the city when I was about 12 and to Lexington, which is not a big city, and that's where I became familiar with horse racing. I had no family that was involved in horse racing, but you know, I loved it from the very beginning. And I went out to Keeneland. I started going out there and making connections, meeting people, and you know, telling them I wanted to be a jockey. And you know, nobody thought I would make it. I don't think, you know, because I didn't have any connections, and I just kept at it and met the right people and developed some relationships where I was able to learn how to gallop horses. And from there, I went to race riding. I rode my first race at Churchill Downs and win my first race at Churchill. So that was a good start. And went on from Kentucky. I was having a hard time getting going, so I went to Maryland. in 1989, and it was just, I was at the right place at the right time. DeZormo was there. He just broke the record for wins in a year. It was just short of 600, which is amazing. Mike Luzzi was there with the Bug, and I was fortunate enough to ride some of his double calls. And when Luzzi lost the Bug, DeZormo went to California. It's like the Red Sea opened.
Perfect opportunity.
Perfect opportunity. It worked out good. I wasn't very good at the time, but I learned fast, you know, riding live horses, and it got a lot better.
So I want to ask you, if your family had no connections in the racing industry, and I come from a similar background, how did that idea come to you to be a jockey?
Just, I mean, it was as simple as riding a few trail horses at my uncle's farm. I mean, that's the only experience I had around horses, and I fell in love with horses immediately. That's all I wanted to do. That's all I could think about. And being at the races with my mother here at Keeneland, you know, as a kid.
That's awesome.
And I mean, I played football in middle school, and that kind of outgrew me. And, you know, I said I wanted to be a jockey, and then I started growing. So
No.
you know, so which was a struggle, you know, for most of my career as far as weight and everything. But, you know, you kind of learn what works for you. And I rode for 15 years, and I had a very good career. Went a lot of races, and to about 200 races a year, almost every year, you know, and that's hard to do. And not being a jock now and seeing how hard it is, working for other jockeys and seeing what a lot of these jocks go through to try to win, you know, just a few races, you know, I really appreciate what a good career I did have, and it's pretty amazing. You know, when you look back and say, you know, that's a lot of races to win in a short period of time.
You should be very proud. You should be very proud.
Very proud of my career.
When you started to walk around Keeneland and telling people that this is what I want to do, I want to be a jockey, and people would look at you and you're 5'8"?
Yeah, I was 14 years old when I first started walking around Keeneland. And I was actually only 5'5", 5'6". I grew a lot all the way into my mid-20s.
Oh, wow.
You know, I was what they call a slow bloomer. And it didn't seem like I was ever going to stop growing. And, you know, I was petrified that I was going to grow out of it. And I fought as hard as I could to stay in it, you know. And eventually it did get the best of me. You know, I couldn't maintain my weight anymore. It was starting to affect my health. It was starting to affect my relationships and you know, every aspect of my life. People don't realize it's not just a physical thing. It becomes emotional and a mental situation when you're reducing so hard and you dehydrate yourself to ride. And I didn't think I could do a good enough job. And I didn't leave planning on retiring. I thought I was just taking a break, but, you know, it became a permanent thing, and I've come to terms with it now. It was hard because that is your life. That's all you do. You know, you wake up every morning, go to the track, breeze horses. You know how it is, and, you know, you go to the jock's room. I mean, it's all-consuming, and on the East Coast in Maryland, you can ride 7 days a week. You know, you can ride at Delaware Park on your dark days. You can go to, like, I read somewhere where you talked about riding at Penn National, and back in, you know, when I was racing, the Meadowlands was still open, so you could get a small plane and fly to Meadowlands and ride there. I mean, it was just saturated, and, you know, that's was really good because you could win a lot of races, and for a guy like me, I didn't like days off because those were days I would become heavy.
Yes.
So
yes.
I took advantage of it, and it really... I stayed sharp that way as well, so, you know, that was good.
And I can't imagine, Mark, of course, I'm a girl, I'm 5'6", and the weight for me was torture. As you mentioned, it's not just the physical side of things, it's the mental torture of just as simple, I used to chew gum all the time, just to be able to have something in my mouth, just that I could feel like I wasn't eating the gum, it was just the chewing. It's such a mental thing as well. What was your daily regimen as far as that's concerned?
I went through a lot of different aspects as far as reducing goes. You know, I did the hot box. You know, I did, you know, like Lasix to lose water weight. And, you know, I did it all the wrong ways. In fact, most of the time, you know. But I thought it's what I had to do. And I loved what I did enough to, you know, sacrifice, like I said, maybe, you know, your health in a sense. And now I'm healthy. I don't have any problems, any kind of lingering kind of health problems because of it. Very fortunate. And I don't regret, you know, a day of anything I did to make it 15 years.
That's fantastic, Mark. And I remember a personal story here. I remember when I hurt my neck and my mother, I was recovering at my mother's house, and I lifted up my shirt. She was going to put a pain patch on my neck. And when I lifted up my shirt, she gasped. You could count every rib. And she was just horrified at the sight of me. And she said I looked like I came from a concentration camp. What did your parents think when you first announced that you were going to ride? And of course, they had to be aware that you were going to have a tough time with the weight. What was their initial reaction?
Like I said, when I was young, I was light. I didn't have, when I rode my first race, I tacked 102. I was really light, even though I was tall.
Wow.
I just had small bones, and I grew a lot into my 20s. You know, my mom was very supportive. My dad, I didn't get to see him a whole lot at that point in my life. And as it got harder and harder, my mother could see, you know, the struggle. And I know she worried about it, but she also knew there was no stopping me either. So, and I think she just thought, hopefully my son uses his best judgment and doesn't push it, you know, too far to where, you know, we have lost a few riders due to reducing, you know. And so, you know, I was fortunate, like I said, to get out in pretty good shape.
What do you think of the weights?
Me personally, I know how hard it is to do the weights, and I know how many jockeys really do suffer to try to do the weight. But at the same time, there's no shortage of riders. And I think if you raise the weights, you would still have the same problem, because you would still have guys that are bigger that are always trying to get down to do the weight. And like I said, there's no shortage of riders. Unfortunately, there's less and less American riders, I believe, because we're bigger than we used to be. You know, Americans.
McDonald's.
Yeah. When basketball first started, they created the height of the goal so you couldn't dunk. Now high school kids dunk for fun.
Exactly.
So, you know, Americans are just bigger. And so there's fewer and fewer American jockeys, you know, as you go through the years. And that's just something. I don't think you can raise the weights either for the, you know, the health concerns of horses. We want to make it a safe sport. We want to make it good for the horses. And I'm not an advocate to raise the weights at all, even though I was a guy that would benefit from it.
Right. Right. And that makes perfect sense, because like you said, there will always be guys too big trying to be too light. And
yeah, I might try to make a comeback.
Oh no. Well, there we go.
That's not going to happen.
Well, you never know. You never know. Don't rule anything out. But let's go back to your first race, Mark, when you made that a winning one at Churchill Downs of all places, and take us back to that day.
That day, it was surreal. The horse really didn't have much shot on paper, and it was for Roxanne Martin was the trainer. Her boyfriend was her partner on the horse, Chris Crow, and the horse's name was Simple Flair. It was in May of 89, and my mom and my grandmother and my sister traveled to the races. We lived in Lexington then. We traveled to the races that day, very nervous, you know, all the jitters and all that. And just, like I said, it seems kind of like a blur, even the race itself. It went by so fast. The horse broke well, was laying probably second or third, kind of drugged me to the lead. And I remember the call even now. Mike Battaglia called the race and said, and Simple Flair blows the turn. For some reason, I almost forgot to make the turn, you know, because I couldn't really believe that I was on the lead by myself. I kind of looked back for, you know, the competition, nobody was there, and she drew off and went pretty easy, paid $49.80.
Wow.
And, you know, I thought it was easy then, but I was pretty sure somebody was going to claim foul on me galloping out because I was so surprised that the horse won and there was nobody around. So I thought,
you took out the whole field.
I thought I took out the whole field, possibly.
Well, thank goodness that didn't happen. But when you won that first race at Churchill Downs, did you intend on staying there at Churchill, or what was your plan of action at that time?
I did. I did plan on staying at Churchill or the Kentucky Circuit. It was toward the end of the meet, and at the time I had an agent named Eddie Campbell. He also worked for a jockey named Brent Bartram, and they were going to Chicago for the summer. So, you know, being I didn't want to change agents or anything like that, I went to Chicago with them, and it was the first year that Chicago, that Arlington reopened after the fire, and it happened to be a very tough meet. You had riders, Pat Day was there, Shane Sellers, Georgie Velasquez, Randy Romero, I mean, the list goes on and
wow.
on. It was a really tough meet, and I couldn't get any traction whatsoever, and while I was there, I got mononucleosis, so ended up having to take like 6 weeks off. I came back to Lexington and rested up. When I came back to Kentucky and tried to get some traction there, it was just nothing there, and I become very frustrated. I was riding two or three horses a week, you know, really just struggling, and I said I gotta make a change. So I talked to a few people. They knew agents in New York and Maryland. They said, you know, I was leaning more toward New York, you know, just because of the prestige of it. And, of course, we always want to make it on the biggest, you know, circuit and the big time, the big show.
Right.
And people talked me into Maryland because of the – they said the bug did very good there, and they named off a bunch of riders like Chris McCarron and Kent DeZormo, Mike Luzzi, and riders like that that had won the Eclipse Award there. So I talked to an agent in New York, and I talked to an agent in Maryland. And I really thought the guy and the agent Bob Suggs in Maryland sold me on him himself, you know, as
right.
an agent.
Right.
And I thought he sounded like the right guy to go to. So I left the next day.
So tell the audience members what that means. The agent sounded like a good agent to go with. What makes a good agent?
I think he was just he was excited about me coming, for one. And he had Garrett Gomez at the time. And Garrett Gomez had just lost the bug. And he did very well in Maryland, you know, with the bug. He won a lot of races. But he just sounded more eager to work for me. I don't know. You just know when it's the right guy, you know. It just felt right. We had a good relationship right from the get-go, and that's why I chose to go to Maryland.
So tell us, how much time did you allow there in Kentucky struggling? How much time did you allow before you decided to pack your bags and make the move?
It was several months. I wasted about 3 months of my apprenticeship.
Wow.
Hanging around, you know, really wanting it to work here because it is, you know, home. And it's a circuit, you know, most jockeys would love to make it on the Kentucky circuit. And it just was not happening. It wasn't happening. And, you know, I've just seen the clock ticking. And I finally made a decision that, you know, this I've got one shot. And I actually only had 7 months left on the bug when I went to Maryland. And in that short amount of time, I won like 335 races.
Wow.
You know, in like 7 months' time. So it was pretty incredible.
And won the Eclipse Award.
Won the Eclipse Award. I was leading rider of the country, you know, of all riders for, you know, the first couple of months of, you know, until I lost the bug. I was, you know, battling with guys like Pat Day for numbers of wins for the year. And, you know, there was some really nice articles in the newspaper, and you know, it looked like I was really going places, you know.
And you did.
And you know, they would write articles and talking about the next DeZormo, and you know, I didn't quite make it that big, but I think I did pretty well considering.
Well, I would say so, Mark. I would absolutely say so. What do you credit that big change, that big difference in how well you did from the move to Kentucky to Maryland? What was the biggest factor in how you took off?
Like I said before, I think a lot of it was timing, and which helped me get on the right horses. And as you well know, that's the name of the game. If you don't have the horse, it doesn't matter how much talent you have. And I hooked up with the right people, you know, when I was there. King Leatherberry, you know, he wins a lot of races in Maryland. And if he's got your back, you know, if he starts riding you, all the other guys, you know, Del Capuano was riding me. And these were the days that those guys pretty much dominated. And if you rode for those guys, you're going to win races, you know. Leatherberry, he'd run five or six a day. You know, three or four of them would be favorites, and you'd win one or two for him. So just getting in with the right trainers, I mean, that's the key. And that helps your confidence. And once your confidence, you know, gets good, and you everything starts to click for you and it starts to work.
How important is that confidence to a rider?
It's everything, in my opinion. And it goes the other way too. When you have a lack of confidence, you can't do anything right. It just goes from worse to, you know, from bad to worse. And the harder you try, the worse things get for you. So, you know, it's either one or the other. There's not a lot of middle ground there. You're either on a roll and making good decisions and choices, and you're confident in yourself, and then you start thinking, what am I doing different? Why am I not winning races? And when you do that, you start to change things. And when you start to change things, you start making bad decisions. And you press, and everything, you know, goes, like I said, from bad to worse.
I remember moments like that in my own career. You're so hungry to do good, and you're not. And you're just desperate to win.
You're desperate to win. And, you know, we don't do anything good when we're desperate, you know, and when we kind of almost panicked, you know, to do good. So it works out. Everything just comes easier when you're confident. And I think that separates the, you know, the really good riders from the just so-so everyday riders. It's just a confidence issue, you know. I don't think there's any more athletic ability or physical ability. I think it's a lot of, you know, your confidence, your mindset, and how you just go through your everyday, you know, routine and make sure that you do the basics well, and, you know, you make as few mistakes as you can. But even when you do make mistakes, you turn the page and go on to the next race, because that race is over and you can't dwell on it.
We'll continue our visit with jockey Mark Johnston after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Get ready for the third annual Jockeys and Jeans charity event to benefit the PDJF, coming to Gulfstream Park on Sunday, February 28th. Last year, Jockeys and Jeans raised more than $200,000 to benefit permanently disabled riders, and you can help make this year's event even bigger. Meet and mingle with an all-star cast of jockeys, including Lafitte Pinkai Jr., Georgie Velasquez, Pat Day, Randy Romero, and many more. Tickets go on sale at the beginning of January, and donations and sponsorship can be purchased starting December 7th. For more information, visit jockeysandjeans.com. Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. First, let's head to California, where Tyler Bayes was the leading rider in earnings for the week. He highlighted the week with a win in the Clocker's Corner Stakes aboard Coastline. Bayes consistently came in the money on 57% of his mounts. He finished the week with 6 wins, 4 seconds, and 5 third-place finishes. Next, let's head to Tampa, where Antonio Gallardo had a great week, highlighted by a win in the Gasparilla Stakes aboard Our Girls a Charmer. Gallardo consistently came in the money 64% of his mounts and finished the week with 8 wins, 5 seconds, and 5 third-place finishes. Next, let's head to Miami, where Joel Rosario had a great week at Gulfstream Park. He won 53% of his mounts, came in the money on 80% of his mounts, and finished the week with 8 wins, 3 seconds, and 1 third-place finish. Finally, our Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Glenn Corbett, had a great weekend at Texas Champions Weekend held at Sam Houston Race Park. He won 3 stakes, including the Yellow Rose, the Richard King, and the Barra Last Stakes. For the week, Glenn finished with 4 wins, 1 second, and 1 third-place finish. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, is the perfect book for anyone who has wondered what it takes to be a professional jockey. The sport's most prominent jockeys and trainers tell their stories and share their insights on all that goes on behind the scenes. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit JockeyTalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigle, joined tonight by jockey Mark Johnston. And Mark, we were just talking before the break about your move to Maryland and how you just took off as soon as you moved there. Who were the influential people in your life at that time? Who coached you along the way? Who mentored you?
That's a good question. There's a lot of different people. I never really tried to style myself after any one particular jockey. I like to try to, number one, being tall made that, you know, hard. So I did favor, you know, tall jockeys, but there wasn't a lot of real tall, successful jockeys, you know, at that time. I think it's become a little more accepted now because, like I said before, how Americans, you know, have they're bigger. So you do see a lot more tall kids that are riding now. And, so there was a, Kent DeZormo was there, and he was winning everything. You know, he was the guy that you wished you could be, because, I mean, he was such a perfect, just everything he did on a horse just looked perfect. And he wins so many races, and you're talking about a guy that was confident. You could just, you know, confidence just beamed from this guy. So I used to watch DeZormo a lot. And at that point in time, too, there was a jock there named Edgar Prado that was doing very well.
Yes.
So me and Edgar, matter of fact, we battled it out a lot. We had a lot of battles, you know. We were good competitors. We got along well. We had our little beefs, through the years, but all in all, we had huge respect for each other, and I think he's a very good rider, and also a rider I have a lot of respect for is Mario Pino. And I would say Mario is probably one of the guys that helped me the most, because we were in the same corner together. We shared the same valet,
So every day I sit next to Mario Pino, and he's a man of few words. But when he does talk, you better listen, because, you know, he really knows what he's talking about. And a guy that just never, very rarely would get emotional, very rarely, you know, would get upset, you know, took everything in stride. And I really needed that, because I was hot-headed. You know, I'd get mad at, you know, just if I didn't win, you know, I was mad and ready to take it out on somebody. So it really helped me, leveled me out being around Mario, and he was a good role model for me. So Mario Pino was probably, and a great rider, very underrated rider. You know, people on the Maryland circuit really know him a lot. He's won 6,000 or 7,000 races, so right. He's been a good rider for a long time. And I think I credit a lot of what I learned from Mario.
And being in the jocks room, of course, we've talked about this on the show before. It is so different in the jocks room because you are surrounded by all of your competitors. You're elbow to elbow. And, of course, fights sometimes break out and things can get heated. But when it comes time to riding your race, you do take care of each other, or you should anyway. And it's like a family in a way. And Mark, I read an article which I found very, very interesting. There was a race apparently in Maryland, and your horse had stumbled, and you were on the back end of the horse, and a fellow jockey helped you back on your horse. Is that correct?
Sure did. That did happen. And it was the first jump out of the gate. My horse veered to the left, I believe. I fell off to the right, and the jock next to me happened to be a jockey named Mark Rosenthal. And he kind of gave me a little elbow, and I kind of leaned on him, and the horses were stride, so it just worked out, and I popped right back up in the irons. And,
wow. You
know, without that little nudge, I'm pretty sure I would have hit the ground, you know. And he never thought anything of it, and, you know, I appreciated it and think I would have done the same thing for him, because it's a very unique situation, the jockey's room. It is it's almost like a team. But you are competitors at the same time. But you do, you have compassion for each other when we're in spills, when we're in accidents. There's nobody that comes together more than jockeys when another rider's hurt. We always would put a sheet of paper on the bulletin board and donate mount fees to jockeys that did get hurt, that were off. And it's a tight-knit group, and I do miss that camaraderie and that jock's room. You're there every day, and you're probably spend more time with them than you do your own family. So it is a very unique situation, and I do miss that a lot. That's one of the parts that I do miss. There's some things I don't, the reducing the injuries, but the jock's room I miss, and the competition as well. And you even have, I mean, you know, even if you have a family member, you know, you're going to beef with sometimes.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's all human nature. That's all natural. That's all normal.
Well, and of course, we know, you mentioned the sheet that goes up in the jocks room for injured jockeys. We all know it can be us at any time. And how do you deal with that when you go out to ride, you're loading in the gate, you can't think about it, but how do you deal with that, that knowledge, knowing that any race could be your last?
I was very fortunate that it was something that never really, I mean, you're aware of it, but it's something that never bothered me. I was able to put that behind me. And in an everyday situation, I'm not the most brave guy in the world. But when it came to riding races and riding horses in that situation, I would go through a hole that no other jock would go through. The other jocks would tell you after the race you were crazy, what were you thinking? I was more afraid of not winning than I was afraid of getting hurt, you know? So to me, I never had to deal with that. And I'd have to imagine it'd be a pretty tough occupation if you were fearful. And I know a lot of riders do deal with that. And it's something that I was able to block out and really, you know, didn't ever have any kind of issues with, you know, riding scared. So I was very fortunate.
You mentioned you were so focused on winning. You were more afraid of not winning than of getting hurt. And of course, you had a tough time with your weight And it is a tough life, of course. Why get up every morning and go out and love that? Why? Describe that. What is it about the sport?
I think, first of all, I love the horses. I love the animal itself. I love the relationship that that you have with the horse, and that you have to get along with that animal and try to get the best you can out of them. And I was always very compassionate toward the horse as well. And I believe that, for me, that's the biggest part of it. I just like winning as well, and I think most people do, whatever it is you do. You know, everybody likes to win. Most people don't like to lose, even though in horse racing, you better get, you know, you don't have to like losing, but you better be able to deal with it. Because, you know, my win percentage for my lifetime is like 16%. So that means I'm losing 85 races out of 100.
And that's a good percentage.
That's a good percentage, but that's a lot of losing. And it's such an up and down game. And in some sense, I think I was attracted to the roller coaster ride, you know, just the bipolarness of it, if that's a word. you know, it's dramatic. It's different every day. It is dangerous. And, you know, I was addicted to all that, the speed of it, the excitement of it. And I guess you could say that I'm kind of a horse racing junkie. You know,
horse racing adrenaline junkie. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for.
Jockey Mark Johnston joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mark, you won 8 Maryland millions in your career. That's an incredible number. I think that's actually third highest of all time. That's an incredible feat.
That was a fun day. I loved Maryland Million Day because you had multiple chances. You know, that's a day that they give away a total purses that equal $1 million. So you have a couple races that are 100,000. There's a few that are 50. I think there's a $150,000 or $200,000 race. I'm sure it's changed through the years. But there was always maybe 6 or 7 Maryland Million races on a card. And that was a day that not a lot of outside jockeys would come in from, like, New York, or that would ship in, because a lot of those horses that ran Maryland Million Day were local horses, of course, because you are in Maryland. So you didn't have the same scenario like during the Preakness, where a lot of the top jocks across the country would ship in. So you had a very good opportunity to ride really, really livestock on that day. And, you know, on a good day, I think I won 3 Maryland Millions on one card.
Wow.
And so like I said, you could stay on your better horses. And that's pretty amazing that, even being retired for 15 years, if that's still, you know, the third highest, you know, that's I didn't know that. Thanks for the info. Yeah.
Glad I could provide that for you, Mark.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Preakness. You rode in the Preakness.
Yes, I
once
did.
For sure. I could be wrong how many times.
I rode the Preakness twice. I actually rode the Preakness the first time when I was an apprentice.
Wow.
And that was very cool. Rode a horse named J.R.'s Horizon. Of course, he was a huge long shot. But just to be there was awesome. It was fun. Even the things that lead up to it, you know, all the press is there, and, you know, you get to do the Preakness breakfast, and, you know, just all the fun things that lead up to it. And the race itself was pretty cool because I was sitting right behind Summer Squall in the race, which, you know, turned out to be the winner. And down the backside, I actually thought I had some horse, and I was following him. And I knew I was in a good position because I was behind Pat Day, and I knew that horse had a real big shot. So, but when we hit the 3/8 pole, his horse went faster and my horse went slower.
Well, you know.
But I still had the best seat in the house.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How did you get that mount in the Preakness when you're an apprentice?
I'd won on the horse 2 times before that race. So I was able to, you know, I was leading rider, so there was really not much reason for them to go to, you know, one of the top riders. And the horse was a long shot, you know. So they did give me an opportunity to ride the horse in the Preakness, which was really cool. And then in 2000, I rode a horse named Marciano for trainer Tim Ritchie. And I believe he finished seventh. And I thought he had a real big shot in the race, you know, for a long shot. I mean, I knew I was up against it, you know, point given. Eventually won the race, and I had a pretty rough trip. I was in the one hole. I got shut off a little bit going into the first turn, and then when Gary Stevens went by me on point given, he shaved me pretty good, you know, because he was going to have to go four wide if I didn't get out of his way, and he had so much more horse than I did, so I kind of had to steady there. And the thing about those big races, I can't imagine the Derby being 20 horses. I never got to ride the Derby. Those guys, they don't give you much shot. You know, that's when all the money's down, all the chips are down, and it's not a friendly race, you know. That's when the jocks, they're not looking out for anybody but themselves, and that, you know, that's the way it's supposed to be. And
such a large field on top of it.
Such a large field, and like I said, that horse finished seventh, which was a pretty good, you know, pretty good finish. Not, you know, nothing to be disappointed about because it was such a tough race, but it was a great experience to go in and think you had some kind of shot.
So you ruled Maryland for quite some time, did extremely well there. In January of 2003, you announced that you were taking a break. Why did you come to that decision?
And what a lot of people didn't know is I was going through some problems with my weight. And I was trying some different things as far as dieting and trying to do things the healthy way, and I knew I would probably gain some weight before I could, you know, do it the right way and get my weight down. And also traveled out to California and spent some time in Arizona with Seth Martinez. He was with my first wife, Jamisa Goodwin. Seth was with her sister, so, and he was riding at Phoenix, the Turf Paradise. And so I actually ended up riding a few races while I was there just to kind of stay fit and that kind of thing. Ended up winning the stake for Simon Bray. And just one of those things, you know, I always just was lucky wherever I went.
Working vacations.
Yeah, working vacation. And I ended up spending a little bit of time in California and met a few people. So I did, I liked it so much and wanted to try it. I spent a few months in California racing and did pretty well. Win a few races, win a race for Wesley Ward, John Sheriffs, you know, some of those guys. Got a chance to ride for some really top guys that I thought were really some of the nicest people and the most classy people in the country. You know, really top guys that treated you really well, and I really enjoyed my experience in California.
What was the difference between riding in California and riding in Maryland?
A lot of it is the track configurations, I think, because if you notice the California tracks, all the straightaways are shorter, and you don't have much of a run from the top of the lane to the wire. So you have to be definitely a lot more aggressive. The jocks ride a lot tighter, and, you know, you're riding against very good riders too. But I always rode against good riders. I mean, in Maryland, like I said, Prado was there, DeZormo, Ramon Dominguez, and so I was used to riding against good riders, and I always enjoyed riding against good riders because I thought you could really predict more what they were going to do than, say, you know, some other riders that were a little bit unpredictable.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
You can say it.
Yeah. So I never, you know, did mind riding against really good riders, and I always thought it made me a better rider.
I would agree completely, just like I believe riding good horses makes you a better rider as well. When you're surrounding yourself by the best, you soak that up.
Yeah, I always think that I didn't really learn how to ride a race until I was put in a position where I was riding really live horses. Because when you're on horses that are just trying to keep up with the pack, you don't learn how to rate a horse. You don't learn how to save ground.
because you're just trying to keep up. You're learning how to switch sticks and switch your goggles. That's about it. Maybe work on your style a little bit, but you're not really learning the tactics of horse racing and, you know, the chess game of it. So until you ride really good live horses every day, you know, you're not gonna improve a whole lot. So it's hard for guys, you know, jocks that don't get the opportunity to ride live horses to get better because they just don't ride those type of horses enough.
Very tough. Very tough.
Very tough.
Mark, describe your style, your riding style. What was that like?
I always think what worked best for me was to really let a horse run their own race, not get in their way too much. As far as, I didn't really like to send horses, you know, off their feet if I didn't have to. And I didn't really like to choke a horse back either. I thought if you could just let them run their race in the bridle just a little bit and let them get their confidence, you know, that you're up there and you're just trying to get them running into your hands a little bit. And I never rode a horse harder than I had to win. I was very conservative with the whip. I wasn't a big stick rider. If I had to get after one, I could. But if I went a lot of races and never cocked my stick, and I was kind of known for that. And I learned that watching Pat Day a lot, because here in Kentucky, he was the king when I was a kid, and he was very conservative with the whip. And I learned how to get horses to run, you know, with my hands. So I think that's pretty much, I really like closing on a horse. You know, there's nothing more fun than come flying at the end of a race, you know, to nip them right on the wire. You know, there's nothing better than that, zigzagging through traffic.
I've said that so many times, yeah. Mark. I completely agree with you. That was my favorite as well. That was the biggest rush in the world to pass everyone. You're flying. They're all stopping, and you just nail them on the wire. That is the greatest feeling in the world.
Yeah, because when you're on the lead, sometimes it's like you're just trying to keep your horse going, and it's almost like this panic feeling, like, you know, they're coming. And you're like, please don't stop. And it's different when you're seeing horses, you know, come to you and you're passing them. And it gives you this feeling of confidence. And when you know you're going to win it, and it's a really good feeling. And I miss that. I miss that part of it.
You described it perfectly too. When you are on the lead, you do feel like kind of a mouse with the cats coming after you.
Yes.
You know they're coming.
And that was, you know, never a good feeling. I didn't think anyway. Like I said, I always liked being in the situation where I could see my competition and know what I had under me and know what they were doing.
The strategy.
The strategy of it all. Yes.
So you're riding in California and eventually you go back to Maryland. Why was that?
I went back to Maryland because that's where I was, you know, I had the best opportunity to ride live horses. And when I was in California, I really liked it, but I wasn't winning enough for me to, you know, keep me content. I was used to riding more horses on a card. I was used to riding more days a week. I wasn't riding enough to keep my weight, you know, maintain my weight as well as I would like. And I like to ride a lot of races, a lot of horses. I wasn't one to want to go in and ride a few races and just ride the big race. You know, if I could ride the card with maybe one in the middle somewhere for a little break, that was a perfect day for me. Or if I rode the card, I was okay with that. You know, more action and more chances to win races. And I wasn't getting that in California. So I did go back to Maryland. And also King Leatherberry was trying to go for one of his milestones. I believe it was 6,000 races or something like that.
Wow.
And I went back to try to win that for him. Unfortunately, he won it during the Timonial meet, the fair meet they have there.
No.
So, yeah, some other kid, you know, I didn't ride much at Timonial. That was actually my vacation time. So he won the race there, and I didn't get to, you know, win that race for him. But, you know, we did give it a good shot. I made the party, you know, the big King Leatherberry 6,000 wins party, which was very cool. And so that was, you know, Maryland was my spot. And I had the most business there. So I pretty much stayed there.
You mentioned an indefinite break during that time when you went to California. Was there ever a time during that period where you thought, you know, maybe I'm going to retire, hang up my tack?
Yeah, but it was only, it was because of the struggle. When I got to my 30s, I really had a hard time with my weight. For some reason, during my 20s, I could maintain and I could manage and still feel good enough and strong enough. And in my 30s, I wasn't able to keep my strength and keep my weight down at the same time. And it just wasn't matching up, you know, with what I wanted to do, because I didn't feel like I was being a good enough rider to go out there and really do what I wanted to do and be happy with my performance. You know, that was starting to fall off a little bit, I think. And I was having, you know, some issues as far as just, you know, my mind, my mentality part of it. And I just wasn't happy, you know, and wasn't really into it like I should have been. And I knew I needed a break from racing.
Well, you did reach that 3,000th mark on September 12th, 2002. You were riding Comba in the second race at Pimlico that day. Take us back to that moment. What was that like? That had to be such a satisfying feeling.
It really was. And I'd been trying for it for a few days. You know how you get to those milestones and you kind of get hung up. And you always seems like it takes you forever to you get there, and then it takes forever to do it. And that's the same situation it was with my 3,000 win. I was riding between Delaware Park and Pimlico, and I'm kind of glad I won it at Pimlico because it was my home track. You know, of course they had the big sign. They had, you know, your name on the infield board. Mark Johnston, 3,000 wins. They made me a leather jacket with embroidered 3,000 wins. They did a lot for me, and it really was special to be able to win it in my home. You know, not my home state, but it's my second home state. You know, it's where I made a career, and that was my home state for horse racing, for, you know, riding races.
Mark, we only have about a minute left, but you did decide to retire in 2004. How did you come to that decision?
It really wasn't a decision that I came to. It was more of a forced issue, as far as I just was never able to get my weight back down. And I always thought for a long time that I would make a comeback and you know, could make a comeback and get it done. And it just never did happen. And I've come to terms with that. And life is good. So, you know, reducing is so hard and keeping your weight down. So you can't do it forever.
That's exactly right. And it is easy to get in denial. I remember when I had my hip replaced, I was determined I was going to come back until they told me, no, you yeah. really shouldn't.
Yeah.
You really shouldn't. But you do. You still miss it.
I still miss it. And I lied to myself about that for years to try to make it feel better when people would ask me, do you miss it? And I'd say, no, why would I miss that? Getting beat up, you know, losing weight every day, not being able to eat, or even worse than that, not being able to drink, being dehydrated. Yeah. You know, why would I miss that? But I really do, you know.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This has been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me. It has been a pleasure.
If you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out the replay on our website, horseracingradio.net, and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal. Thank you for listening.